Some people are shouters and some people are not, and for the most part, I'm not a shouter. So it always fascinates me when going like to a Vikings game and seeing people with their faces, their heads painted in purple and wearing bizarre outfits and having loud noise-making devices and yelling until they're hoarse and exuberant over an intercepted pass or some tremendous play or an unexpected touchdown, and the crowd just goes wild, and I smile. And once I actually got caught up and clapped. But let me tell you that there was one Sunday when the whole crowd shouted with loud voices. I mean, just everybody. It wasn't a sports event. It was more of a religious parade. And it wasn't for a team. It was for a teacher named Jesus Christ. It was the day that we have dubbed Palm Sunday, although it's interesting that Luke, in his biography of Jesus, never mentions palms and doesn't call it Palm Sunday. He sort of bypasses the other references in other biographies to the palms that were being waved by the people and focused instead on the shouting and the excitement that was most memorable. The story begins with Jesus walking the 17 uphill miles from the town of Jericho to the city of Jerusalem. And as he was doing it with an entourage, the word spread ahead, and people in Jerusalem anticipated that he was coming. And there was excitement. Well, there was also some fear. You see, there was a widespread notion in those days that old predictions were going to come true about a king, a general, a Messiah, who would bring independence to the nation of Israel, would chase out the Roman occupying army, do wonderful things, all in the name and the power of God. Except there were some who thought that Jesus was clearly not the one, and they were fearful that he would cause more trouble than he was worth. Jesus approached the city of Jerusalem from the east, and as he neared one of the suburbs, he turned to two of his friends and asked them to go into one of the suburbs, and there they would find tied up a donkey. And they should take the donkey, and if the owner of the donkey objected, all they need to do is look him in the eye and say, "The Lord needs it." Some people think that's a miracle. You know, they make a list of all the miracles of Jesus, and this would be a numbered item on the list. Not that he couldn't have miraculously persuaded the owner of a donkey to give it up, but I don't think there's anything miraculous here at all. I think it was pre-planned. I think that Jesus anticipated that Sunday when he would come into Jerusalem, that he had made arrangements with the owner of the donkey to have it tied at exactly the place where it should be, and there was a password. So if anybody else tried to take the donkey, they would be stopped, but as long as someone says, "The Lord needs it," then the donkey would be turned over to whoever those strangers may be. Now, I need to explain some things. I need to explain that the plan means that Jesus was premeditated in what he was about, and that this was courageous. Courageous because people understood the symbols of everything that was happening. I guess that everybody in the city of Jerusalem, probably from childhood, had learned, if not memorized, the words of what we would consider to be an obscure Old Testament prophet named Zechariah. In Zechariah 9:9 were the words, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey." On a colt, the foal of the donkey. In other words, everyone expected that this Messiah, this king, this general, would someday triumphantly come into the city of Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Now, donkeys may not be very impressive to us, but they had different connotations in that time and culture than they do today. In fact, if you go to work tomorrow and someone calls you a donkey, don't say thank you. That's not intended as a kind compliment, but it could be in the first century. In fact, there was a wide-known tradition that said that when a king comes into a city riding on a horse, that means that the king is coming for war. But if the king comes riding on a donkey, that means that the king is coming for peace. So everyone knew the symbol. Everyone knew what Jesus was doing. But you also need to know that there was an arrest warrant out for Jesus. That's told in another biography in John 11:57. And that as soon as Jesus showed up, either in or around the city of Jerusalem, the police would arrest him, he would be tried, and he would be at risk of execution. Now, put all of that together, and you begin to understand what Jesus was doing. He was that day announcing, coming out as the Messiah. So there would be no doubt. He was also putting himself at tremendous risk that he would be arrested and tried and maybe even crucified. But knowing all this, he did it anyway. Entered the city of Jerusalem. What a courageous thing to do. Now, I have a theory. You can try it on yourself. I think it applies to many of us. The theory is that we somehow in life intuitively avoid problems and pain. And that what we do is we look at whatever the difficulties in our lives are today, and we think, if I can get this health problem solved, or I can get some more money, or I can fix this relationship, or I can take care of whatever is troubling me, the rest of life is going to be great. It's going to be sort of home free, totally unrealistic. But certainly, we don't seek, we don't walk into problems and pain. But Jesus did. He did it because he knew it was right. He did it because he knew that his calling in life, his mission, was to obey God and to go to Jerusalem and there to be crucified and to die to pay for human sin. And so it was with great premeditated courage that he did this amazing thing. When Jesus came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. And it was marvelous. It was spontaneous. It was exhilarating. It was enthusiastic. They saw Jesus coming. They began shouting and screaming and quoting the Bible. Have you ever felt that? Have you ever gotten so excited about Jesus, so connected to him, that you kind of lost control? I have. I can tell you about a quiet experience. It was here at Wooddale Church. It was on a Sunday when, like today, we were celebrating communion. I was responsible for leadership of that communion celebration. The trays were being distributed, and I was praying. And something happened. I had an experience with Jesus Christ. I was talking to him, I was listening, I was loving, I was worshiping. I was oblivious to whatever else was going on around me. The music stopped, I didn't move, everyone was waiting, I sat there, I just lost it. Another pastor of Wooddale had to come over and grab me by the arm and kind of shake me and bring me back to my responsibilities. It was this quiet, kind of indescribable ecstasy experience with Jesus. But I can tell you of other times that have been loud, that have been musical, where my soul has been stirred and the connection has been made, that somehow with the music and the fellowship and the words and even to my non-musical mind and heart, there was a connection that was there. And I became, in some ways, unaware of whoever was around me and whatever was happening, and in other ways, more connected to other Christians than at probably any other times. I'm stumbling to describe it, but it's a wonderful thing. And then I can tell you about other times when I just looked around. I've looked at you and others, and I've watched people worship. Sometimes I watch people as they worship, and their heads are down, and you just sort of sense that there's almost an aura to them in their worship of God and their connection to Him. And there are other people whose heads are uplifted, sometimes their hands uplifted, and there's a joy and a smile and a kind of body language that you just know that they are there with God in worship and oblivious to whether the people around them are kneeling or standing or sitting or clapping or doing anything else. Let me tell you that even if you're not a shouter, Jesus Christ makes you shout on the inside, and sometimes that shouting on the inside when you love and worship Him, it just sort of leaks out. I mean, it's just got to get out. It's there. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. So try to picture what happened there that day. It was stunning. God was watching. Jesus was courageously putting His life on the line, entering the city of Jerusalem. Old prophecies were that day, at that moment, coming true. And His disciples, they were shouting, they were worshiping, they were praising, they were quoting the Bible. And then some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples. Tell them to shut up. This isn't the way you worship. There's something wrong here. Tell them to tone it down a little bit. This is out of line. This is not the way we do it. And we want this stopped right now. We're not going to deal with every one of them because it's a crowd. But you're the leader, so you're responsible to make sure that they're rebuked." And it's a piece of the story that saddens my heart. Kind of wish it weren't there. But it saddens my heart not just because of what happened then, but because of some things that are happening in North America, the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century. Maybe you know about it. If not, I'm glad you're ignorant. It's what some people have called the worship wars that have divided Christians and churches over styles of worshiping Jesus Christ. There's some who say that the way they worship God is with an historic liturgy. And there are others who look and listen and say, "Oh, that's terrible. That's dead. That's lifeless. That's unspiritual." And there's some who say that they must worship with traditional hymns. And they say that these traditional hymns encapsulate Christian theology, that they are a tool of teaching as well as a means of praise and adoration, that they are a means of connecting the church today with the church of other generations. And there are other people that say, "That's human words. You can't sing that stuff. Sing the words of the Bible. The scripture is far superior than anything that is a human concoction." And some say, "You know, when you come to worship God corporately, you need to dress up. You need to have your very best clothing on. If you were going to meet some famous royal or political figure, you would have on your best clothes then. If you were going on an important interview tomorrow, you'd be as dressed up as you thought you could possibly be." And somebody else says, "Wait a minute. God looks not at the outside, but the inside. We're not trying to impress God. We are here for Him to speak to us, and we are here to worship Him." And there's some who say, "You know, contemporary music touches the soul and enables me to connect with God." And other people say, "But it's too loud. God's not deaf. You don't have to raise it to 1,000 decibels. Tone this thing down a little bit. God can hear. It's okay." And there's some who clap, and they say, "I clap because the Bible tells me to clap." And others say, applause is something that you do at a rock concert. It's not something you do in the worship of God." And I look and I listen at all this and I think to myself, is it possible? I mean, is it possible that some of these Pharisees are still here? They're 2,000 years old? I mean, could that be? Is it possible for somebody to live that long? I have worshiped God in the architectural wonder of Westminster Abbey in London, and my soul has been stirred. And I have worshipped God to the beat of African drums in a sugarcane plantation in Kenya, where the only shade was from palm leaves overhead, and the service was very long and very different. I have worshipped God to what I think are the impressive and wonderful words of the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. And I have worshipped God in Pentecostal revivals that were loud and swinging. And I've worshipped God to the sound and to the music and to the experience of Southern gospel music. My heart has connected with the Lord. And I've worshipped God with the most traditional of evangelical worship experiences and the most contemporary. And I will tell you that what matters most is not the style of worship, but it is that we worship this God in spirit and in truth. And that before we criticize, that we take heed that we not be like those Pharisees, and if we are like those Pharisees, that we have the courage to listen to the words of Jesus when he says, "I tell you that if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." That worship of Jesus cannot be contained, and if we will not do it with our lips, if the sound will not come from our larynx, that God will, if necessary, take the inanimate stones to cry out in worship and praise of Jesus Christ. So I invite you to worship him with all of your soul and mind and heart and spirit and body, to worship him in ways that will make you want to just shout praises to our glorious Jesus Christ. Now that historic day had one more twist to it. You know, it's kind of interesting. We plan and we anticipate the way things are supposed to be, a wedding, an anniversary, a family gathering, a retirement party. And then somebody does something or something happens and plans just never come out as perfectly as we anticipated them. And so it was with the criticism and the rebuke that came from the Pharisees. But there was another twist to that amazing day. And it came when Jesus was seized with sadness. For as he was coming down the road toward Jerusalem, apparently he took a turn at a bend in the road and at that moment saw the panorama of the city of Jerusalem. As amazing and magnificent now as then, and then as now. He saw the thousands of little houses made of native stone and clay. He saw the swirling smoke that came from the kitchen fires. Maybe he could even see from the distance the people who were milling around in the marketplace, but certainly he could see the architectural wonder of Jerusalem, which was the temple on top of Mount Zion. And without a doubt, the large wall that encompassed the city, and straight in front of him, the Eastern Gate, today called the Golden Gate of Jerusalem. He saw it all, knew it was the place where that next week he would die. And Jesus wept. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it. He didn't cry because he knew he was going to die. He cried for the people, because he knew that there was a huge gap between what could be and what would be. You see, Jesus dreamed of peace and purpose, of salvation and hope. His dream for them then was the same as his dream for us now, the dream of God. The dream of God for the best for all of us. But instead, Jesus foresaw the calamity that was to come. Understand that Jesus was and is God, and that as God, he knew the full future before it happened. He knew not only the options that were available to the people of Jerusalem, but he knew the personal choices that they would individually and corporately make together, and he knew what would be the consequences of terrible choices. He said that the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. And with supernatural accuracy, four decades later, in the year AD 70, the predictions of Jesus came true. It was at a time when there was a lot of turmoil, political and military, across the Roman Empire. And the Caesar sent his son, a general named Titus, to quell the uprisings that were taking place in Palestine. When Titus arrived, he found that the zealots were courageous and too effective in their guerrilla warfare. There was a massacre at a place called Masada, and Jerusalem would not surrender. And so he instructed his legions in record time to build an embankment around the city of Jerusalem for a siege. But the soldiers were also able to breach the wall. And when they marched into Jerusalem, there was a massacre that took place, killing not only adults, but massacring children until blood ran in the streets, and those that were not killed were taken as slaves. And Titus was determined that he would make a lesson out of the city of Jerusalem and totally destroy every building in it. So every single house was taken down. The wall was completely destroyed. No stones were left piled upon the other. The temple was devastated. Of the entire city and all of its architecture, Titus left three pillars standing, and that was all. And he took from the temple a golden candelabra that had been used in Jewish worship, and took it and the slaves back to the city of Rome, where he entered in triumphant procession, carrying the golden candelabra and dragging the slaves behind. In fact, if you have been to or you ever visit the city of Rome, your tour guide will probably show you the Arch of Titus, which was built then in commemoration of the victory over Jerusalem. And when you visit the Arch of Titus, you will see the carvings on the side, including the candelabra and including the Jewish slaves. Jesus had predicted exactly what would happen, and it happened. But let me tell you that the Christians did not die in AD 70. And the reason the Christians didn't die is because they knew these words of Jesus. And so when they saw them being fulfilled with the Roman army coming, the entire Christian community abandoned Jerusalem and went to a place called Pella. And there they all survived the destruction of the city. And there they all spread out in fulfillment of the great commission of Jesus Christ to spread his gospel around the world. Jesus foresaw those that would take less than the best. He foresaw the gap between what could be and what would be. And Jesus cried. Now, I told you that I don't shout at the Metrodome. I smile. I've sometimes wondered what would happen if they had 60,000 fans just like me on national television. It'd be a terrific victory, and there'd be 60,000 smiles in silence across the stadium. But I'm married to someone who does shout at games. Embarrassingly so, sometimes. She doesn't shout at home, but she does shout a lot at sports events. But let me tell you that when it comes to Jesus, you can shout. He's worth shouting for. You can be exuberant. If that exuberance is merely contained in your heart, so be it. But don't be surprised if you fall so much in love with him, if you experience him so deeply, that even uncharacteristically, the quietness breaks away into shouts for Jesus Christ. But whatever you do, don't miss the ecstasy of worshiping the Son of God. Don't get to the end of your life and think to yourself, I've heard stories from other people I've been impressed by what they have said, but I've never actually experienced that myself. I invite you to abandon your heart to the praise of Jesus Christ, to get so focused on him that you don't know if the person next to you is whispering or shouting, if that person is clapping or kneeling. Just love Jesus. Worship him. Feel him. Experience him. Know him. But don't make him cry. Please, don't make him cry. Don't miss out on what could be. Don't ignore the dreams that God has for your life. Don't settle for anything else than God's best for you through Jesus Christ. Our Father in heaven, our hearts are full of love and admiration and adoration for Jesus, he who so courageously did what you called him to do and gave his life for us. Lord, may your best of dreams for all of us and for each of us come true, I pray, through your Son.